Hello everyone, and welcome to the File Room Podcast, a podcast about the X-Files.
That is also a desperate attempt to reconnect a friendship across the Atlantic.
I'm Edwin Davis.
And I'm Michaela Livingston Banks.
If you're new to the X-Files or watching it for the 10th time, watch along with us while we explore the dark corners of the American psyche.
Via a TV show from the 90s.
So, Michaela, how have things been for you this week?
They have been snotty.
Mm-hmm.
TMI.
Fun.
Because always fun. Can make paper mache models out of snotty tissues. There's so much of it. I've been okay. I'm ill, but mm-hmm. You know that kind of ill where actually you feel mostly fine, but your nose is like, ah. Just going to make life real disgusting for you. So it's been a bit like that. Obviously, the big news being that I think I've sold my house, or at least Yay. Got to the point where we've accepted an offer. And we just have to go through all the joyous conveyancing process. That's fun. John's been away at a conference all week, so I've been watching feminist movies and reality TV. As one does.
All the things that he doesn't let you watch when he's around, because he's very domineering and controlling.
He is incredibly dominant. It's more the stuff I'm too embarrassed to make him watch, but, you know, he would never judge, of course, because he's lovely.
Yeah. I couldn't even get through the end of that sentence, the idea of John, he's such a nice man.
Exactly. But it's funny because the last time he went away, I watched Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
And then this time I watched Poor Things. Yeah. But now I'm like, he hasn't seen these movies and I need him to watch them so we can talk about them. And you haven't watched Poor Things either, Ed, so I can't even talk to you.
I'll watch it this week and we can talk You'll, about okay. it next week. We'll make this a mini podcast within the main podcast where we talk about Poor Things.
Excellent. But yeah, how's your week been?
Good. I had a minor existential crisis yesterday when I went to the grocery shop because I saw a guy wearing a t-shirt with Charlie Sheen's face and winning on, which obviously is a reference to when he had his big meltdown when he got fired from Two and a Half Men. And I just really felt like I had become unstuck in time. The idea that someone would be wearing that t-shirt in 2024 was just so perplexing to me, because that was such a small window of time in which that took over pop culture, sort of a 6 month period in early 2011. So it was just, it's just very strange. Most of the time when I see like old memes and stuff on t-shirts, I don't think much about it because some of them persist, you know, they continue going on. I wouldn't think, like, I would think it was gauche if someone was wearing like a lolcats t-shirt or something, but it wouldn't, it wouldn't send me into a spiral. But you know, the fascination that everyone had with Charlie Sheen and posting like Tiger Blood and Warlock and stuff was so, such a brief blip in pop culture that the idea that someone would think, I'm going to wear this t-shirt to go and do my grocery shopping. I don't know. It was just very, very strange to me.
I mean, it would be really corny to wear it at the time, but I feel like it's really smart to wear it now.
Yeah, I suppose so. Because then, at the time, people watching it would be like, oh, that guy's too online. And now, I guess it's retro. Like 13 years, I guess it is retro to be wearing a Charlie Sheen meme t-shirt. But no, other than that, yeah, I had a good week. I also was a little bit ill in the week. I think it was probably just like really bad allergies, because sometimes the pollen gets very, very high and I just get thunderingly horrible headaches. So I had that on Thursday morning where I just woke up with a pounding headache and all congested. And just sounded awful on Zoom calls and things like that. So that wasn't fun. It was one of those things where like it got to like 3 o'clock and I was mostly fine, but for the first half of the day I was just feeling really awful and sorry for myself. And then in my quest to try and watch 1,000 movies this year, which is still going fairly strong, I filled in another kind of weird blind spot for me of a movie from the 90s that I feel like not a lot of people saw, but people kind of referenced, which was The Phantom with Billy Zane. which is a adaptation of like a comic strip from the 40s, which is mostly forgotten, but is very notable because the Phantom himself is a ridiculous looking character who wears a skin tight purple bodysuit. And I was...
Oh, it's coming back to me. It's coming back to me. I'm going to Google it. No, it's not. Oh, yeah. I mean, I recognize the character probably from the earlier, like, seeing the comic, but I can't say I ever saw this movie coming out.
Yeah. It's not a particularly good movie, mainly because it was originally written as a comedy, but then they tried to make it as a serious movie. Well, not serious, an earnest movie, I should say.
Oh,
without really changing the script, because they changed directors, but then they didn't really change the script. So it's got this weird thing where there are moments in it that are clearly meant to be jokes, but they're not sold as jokes. So it kind of all falls really flat. But I'm just really fascinated by that and The Crow, which we talked about previously, where like there was this run of films in the late 80s, early 90s, where the first Tim Burton Batman was a huge success. And then... instead of everyone in Hollywood thinking what we need to do is just turn all of these superhero comics into movies, which didn't happen until sort of the end of the 90s, they thought, why don't we turn all of these pulp hero comics from the 40s into movies? So you get Dick Tracy, you get The Shadow, you get The Phantom. The Crow kind of is on the edge of that because obviously that's a comic from the 80s. But they basically went entirely around the edges of how do we make superhero movies by just going... people like Batman because he's from the 40s and he's dark and gritty. So let's just do that, not because he's a superhero. And let's just make a ton of superhero movies. And I find those movies all really fascinating because it's from a period when no one really knew how to make a superhero movie. They didn't really know what they were doing. So you have all these fascinating misfires. And movies like Dick Tracy, which I do think is genuinely quite good, but is also insane because they just try and make it look as much like the comic as possible. So everyone's wearing mad makeup and prosthetics and no one looks human. And it's just a bizarre movie. But I was happy to have finally seen it, even if I did spend the whole movie thinking, why doesn't this totally work? Why it feels like this should be funny, but no one's kind of really going for the gag. And then later reading up on it, thinking, oh, I see, that's why. Because they hired a comedy guy to make it, and they fired him. And then they got someone who doesn't know how to make a comedy to make the movie.
See? You need the right people. Need the right people to make the things.
Yeah. Which brings us, I think, to this episode of The X-Files. Because maybe from the writing perspective, this episode didn't have the right people in place, maybe.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about the episode Young at Heart. Michaela, why don't you give us a synopsis of Young at Heart?
All right. So in this episode, the cold opener is set in a prison in 1989 where we see Crandall, a wheelchair-bound inmate, hearing screams. Upon investigating, he finds something like an operating theatre where he sees a doctor menacingly standing over another inmate, John Barnett, whose hand appears to have been amputated. The doctor declares Barnett dead and threatens Crandall when he questions this. On leaving, Crandall sees Barnett's eyes blink. Fast forward to present day, which in this case is 1993, Mulder and Scully are called in by Mulder's former mentor, Reggie Perdue, to a jewellery heist. There's been a taunting note left, leading Mulder to suspect the deceased Barnett, as this was something he had done in the past. This case echoes Mulder's first FBI assignment, which we learn more about during the episode. The case involved a standoff between the FBI and John Barnett, where Mulder could have taken a shot at Barnett, but because he had a hostage, Mulder hesitated, and in the end, Barnett shot the hostage and also an FBI agent who died. Despite acting by the book in this case, Mulder is clearly upset and holds a lot of regrets, which we see in various scenes, including a flashback to John Barnett's trial, where Mulder gives testimony on the stand and bursts out at Barnett, calling him an animal. A handwriting expert reluctantly confirms the note's authorship as Barnett's, albeit with some reservations. Amidst escalating threats, including sinister surveillance of Mulder, more notes and direct phone confrontations, the mystery deepens. Barnett kills Reggie Perdue and also targets Scully. He goes to her apartment but is interrupted when a doctor, Dr. Ridley, who we see in the cold opener, shows up at her door. Mulder and Scully question Dr. Ridley, and in doing so uncover his unethical aging experiments, supposedly seeking to treat the genetic disease progeria, where children age prematurely, which suggests a bizarre connection between Barnett's supposed death, why they don't recognise him, because he looks younger, and illicit scientific pursuits for eternal youth. This includes the fact that Dr. Ridley made use of signalling molecules from salamanders to regrow Barnett's amputated hand, explaining how he was able to write his notes. We also learn from Deep Throat that the experiments were of interest to the government and that Barnett has stolen the research, so the government are trying to bargain with him to get hold of it. Because Barnett hacked into Scully's answering machine, they think he's going to use the intel that she's seeing a friend before her cello recital, and so they set up a sting at the theatre to catch him. The narrative culminates in a tense showdown at said cello recital. Barnett shoots at Scully and Mulder takes chase, facing down Barnett once again as he takes the cellist hostage. Despite the high stakes, Mulder acts decisively, shooting Barnett. Scully was wearing a Kevlar vest, so it's fine. And the episode ends with Barnett on an operating table, an agent desperately trying to get information from him, but he dies without revealing the location of the research. The last shot of the episode focuses on a left luggage locker, with Mulder saying that he thinks this isn't the last we'll hear from John Barnett. And that's it. That was a bit of a wild ride.
Yeah, I think this episode, I was looking up some reviews online before watching this, and this episode generally seems to be considered pretty negatively, and I also think it's a somewhat weaker one. But I think that synopsis kind of points to it having problems similar to episodes we've talked about in the past, like Conduit, where it feels like, and Conduit I feel has already just become our shorthand for episodes that have good ideas but don't really work. Where it feels like the writers, who in this case are Scott Corfer, who was a freelance writer who Chris Carter had worked with previously when they were both at Warner Brothers, and Chris Carter, who took the script and rewrote it. They kind of throw in a lot of ideas into this episode, but it never really feels as if a lot of them click. But also in watching it, I thought there's some elements of it that feel better than episodes that do similar things. Like, I think that the relationship that Mulder has with Reggie Perdue is a somewhat improved version of his relationship with Jerry in Ghost in the Machine, where again you have someone from Mulder's past who comes and asks him for help on a case and then dies halfway through the episode. But here, I think the fact that it's a fairly warm mentor-mentee relationship, it feels a little more elegant, it feels a little more earned, and so you genuinely do feel a little more for Perdue when he dies, even though it also feels like a wasted opportunity. It's like, that seems like a character you could have brought back and done more things with. Yeah, so I think we can get into more specifics, but I think overall my view of this episode is it feels like a slightly better version of some of the weaker episodes we've talked about in some respects, but still it doesn't really work particularly well.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely in that family of episodes where you get a nice little character, bit of character development. So we learn more about Mulder's earlier life as an agent and that he hasn't always been perfect. Or at least in this case, he was perfect in as much as he acted by the book, but he still has a lot of regrets and things about it. And maybe we could read into that, that maybe this is part of why he doesn't always completely go by the books now, as it were. But yeah, certainly that aspect of it is interesting, and I felt like I was with this episode for the first half or two-thirds maybe, where I guess we already know what the situation is to some extent because of the cold opener. But equally, they're trying to figure out, like, is it actually this guy? Is it not? Like, how's this all working? Like, there's a big question mark in your head. And that's always nice to have in a kind of crime drama mystery as that setup. And to some extent, I guess I was wondering, what's X-Filey about this? Has someone come back from the grave, or what's the situation? But I was with it until the weird conspiracy science experiment stuff was thrown in. And not because I don't enjoy those sorts of things, because I clearly do.
Mm-hmm.
But just because it seemed like it was like, okay, this is something too much. And yeah, afterwards when I was reading up on various things about this episode, what one of the aspects was that the salamander hand bit of the writing came from Chris Carter. And I was like, ah, oh, why'd you do that, Chris? Why? This would have been okay without that. Or if the kind of the desire for de-aging was more central in the plot, maybe that would have made it better. Having said that, once the salamander hand is in the equation, I'm like, that's fun. That's silly. But it just feels like you've got two different episodes happening, which is pretty much what was the case in Conduit. You've got a nice bit of characterization going on and then too much everything else.
Yeah, and I think it's funny the whole element of at one point Mulder goes to a bar with Deep Throat and while they're enjoying a nice pint. Deep Throat basically does the same thing that he does in Ghost in the Machine, where he says, oh, the government's interested in this. But that also feels weird because it doesn't... the idea of having de-aging technology, obviously, yeah, people being able to extend their lives, presumably indefinitely, obviously that would be a major development. But also, it doesn't quite have the same urgency to it that in Ghost in the Machine had, where the idea that, oh, we've created this AI that could run all of our warfare for us or whatever. Yeah. So it doesn't feel like it has quite the same urgency as in that episode. So it kind of feels strange that Deep Throat would come in to talk to him about it and say, oh, by the way, the government's also interested in this. It feels like it would have been fine to not have the government angle, although it is fun that at the end you do get William B. Davis showing up as as the CIA agent in the operating room screaming at Barnett to try and get him to
blink and you miss it.
Now, they flew in three specialists to try to save his life. That guy in the ugly suit there is probably CIA. He's been trying to talk to him.
Is Barnett conscious?
Yeah, but he's not talking.
Which I liked, especially because they don't really draw attention to it. If I hadn't seen his name in the credits, I wouldn't realize that was Cigarette Smoking Man
doing that.
It reminded me very much of... there's a video game from the late 90s called Half-Life, which is famous for having a supporting character called the G-Man, who's kind of like this guy in a suit who's clearly inspired by the Cigarette Smoking Man and similar characters, who you first see in that game just through a window as you're taking a tram to work at in the opening level. And I like when you have things like that where, Leo, a major character is just around and you just kind of, oh, wow, okay, yeah, that guy's back, cool. So I do find it fun that he's in it, even if, again, it does add to the sense that this is an episode that is a little overstuffed.
Yeah, a bit overcomplicated, maybe. The other thing is... well, I did think that they could have easily have made space for exploring the de-aging aspects more in the plot or something, because they did explain Mulder's backstory to this in like three different ways, and you learn more or less exactly the same information. Certainly twice in some detail, because like the first time Mulder was like, oh, an agent got killed and it was my fault. And that's the first kind of hint at it. And then Reggie talks Scully through what happened and shows like the CCTV footage of it all. So you kind of see it through that angle. And then Mulder has his flashback to the courtroom where he's giving testimony and he basically describes exactly what we saw and heard in the CCTV footage and from Reggie's description. And I was just like... okay, the outburst bit, that kind of tells us something new and takes us a bit forward in what we're understanding about that whole situation and how Mulder feels about it.
He gunned him down just for spite.
Your Honor, we object.
Witness will step down.
There's a man with a wife and two small children, and you shot him without...
I'll be
hesitation, without conscience, without an ounce of humanity.
Your Honor, do something.
Which is why you should die like an animal,
Agent
you
Mulder,
son of
do
a
not
bitch.
Stop. I will find you in contempt of court.
We know he's quite upset about it in the way that he responds to Scully when she tells him that Reggie had shown her this. So it's just, yeah, it was just like the multiple explanations of the same thing we already know, and then get a little bit of I was just like, this is all, you know, when you get pulled out of something, like you're watching it. I think that's maybe for me, I think I've said it before, one of the signs of when I know I've really enjoyed an episode is because you're not looking at the mechanics, especially the first time you're watching it through. You're not looking at the mechanics of it. You're just being taken along for the ride. And then it's the end and you're like, that's enjoyable. Whereas with this one, I was taken along for the ride somewhat, but I was also pulled out of it a fair amount and just being like, why did they do that? Like, at the time. And to me, that's kind of a sign of not very good TV.
Yeah, it definitely feels like they rehash all of the stuff about Mulder's backstory way too often in this episode, because it really feels as if the first time you hear about it, they give away all the details about
basically,
it, and then each subsequent repetition of it is really just telling us things we already know. If the first time it comes up, Mulder was maybe a little more hesitant about the details, and then Scully sees the video and then it reveals something new, and it doesn't really. The only thing that's new about it is that she sees that Mulder had the shot, but I don't feel like that's too new compared to everything else.
Well, was it Mulder or was it Elvis? Because at the end of that scene, you know, it kind of does a close-up of the TV screen paused on Mulder. And it was just like, well, that's a man in a wig. And both John and I were like, oh, it looks like Elvis.
Yeah, Mulder had a real sudden change in his hairstyle in the preceding 7 years, or however long it's meant to have been between that happening. Yeah, it does feel as if this episode is spinning its wheels quite a bit. And then, yeah, I just think that courtroom scene as well, the only thing that's new, one, you see that he was very emotional when he had his outburst on the stand, which, you know, is a different thing, I guess, and does at least show a kind of youthful emotionality to Mulder that you don't see a lot in the rest of the series, because he's much more kind of buttoned down a lot of the time. So I think that's interesting, but really the only reason it's there is so that David Peterson, who plays the old John Burnett, can slowly and sinisterly drink a glass of water and then mouth, I'm going to get you, or whatever he says to Mulder in the courtroom. And yeah, each time it doesn't feel like we're learning something majorly new that advances the plot or deepens the character. It just feels like, yeah, a lot of this stuff could have been pushed to the side and maybe focused on other things. I think as well, we mentioned a little bit, progeria, which is a real disease that essentially they describe it as basically premature aging, which is it's more or less correct. Obviously, it's a simplification of what happens with it, but it's for the purposes of the episode, it's close enough. I feel like that stuff comes in a little too late and could have been developed more. It's like a very fascinating element, and like you say, could have made the de-aging stuff really central to it, instead of it being suddenly kind of brought in and feeling very much like a Deus Ex Machina of explaining, oh, why is it that this guy that has been dead for 4 years is around and no one recognizes him? Oh, it's because he now looks younger than he was.
Is that Dr. Ridley?
Yes, in 1974. Joe Ridley thought that he could take their accelerated aging and slow it down. Initially, some of his lab work was promising, but then things got out of control. He wanted to begin human trials.
Why wasn't he allowed to?
Because he hadn't met the criteria. It was all too hypothetical, too dangerous. I mean,
although I do like that element of it, when Mulder first stumbles on the idea that maybe he's younger, he goes to the FBI agent whose job it seems to be to just sit at a computer and work the de-aging program, the aging up program that she usually does. And, you know, he de-ages the picture of Barnett by 10 years or whatever, and then he just looks like Saul Goodman, which was very fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does feel like there's a lot of half-developed ideas in this episode, all of which that if you kind of like pulled them out and made them the centerpiece of the episode would altogether make it stronger, but instead they all feel like they're competing against each other.
Yeah, it's funny because I know last week off mic we were like talking about whether or not we could remember this episode because I was thinking Young at Heart, and obviously by the end of it I was like, well, I obviously remember the salamander hand, but it just hadn't clocked in my mind as that was linked with like the de-aging thing. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just me, because in my head the science of those two things aren't actually all that interrelated, because regenerating limbs as salamanders and some other like lizards and what and amphibians can, that isn't really related to like aging and how cells age and how organisms age. Like, I can get why maybe you'd think it is, because like, ooh, a new limb, that's young, it's a young limb, but like they're different things. They're still cool, like, you know, they talk about the experiments of like using certain cell signals to like say to a salamander or whatever, grow a new limb here.
You were able to grow John Barnett a new hand?
Not exactly, not a human hand anyway. I could never get the cells to divide and behave properly.
I'm afraid to ask. What kind of hand did you grow?
There'd been some successful work done in London. By taking samples of what we call cell morphogens from an amputated salamander arm and applying them to the back of the creature, they were able to grow a new limb on a completely different part of the body. But only on salamanders.
Until John Barnett.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, the experiments where they can, you know, I think in fish as well, where you can cut fins or tails and things like that, and they will regenerate and grow. And the various other things they've done when they were learning about developmental biology, like how does a frog know to grow a leg where a leg is? And, you know, that's really cool. And, like, you can definitely imagine that kind of Frankensteinian, like, what would happen if we tried to do that with humans. I mean, I think the reality is that if there was a cell signal that said grow new hand here, it would be a human, probably a weird human hand that would grow, not a salamander hand. But it's a super fun idea. And I remember in university, you know, learning about these experiments where in order to learn about what happens normally, you mess things up a bit and see what happens. And that was all super fascinating and cool. So it is cool, but it is in my head at odds to what is also super cool, and that is the science of aging and senescence and things like that. So I'm slightly sad that they couldn't have gone more into it, although I can't remember and I haven't done my research about like what science we actually knew back in like 1993. On that level, they do talk about with progeria and the whole aging, de-aging thing, something about myelin. And
you see, myelin is not present in the very young, and by reversing the effects of aging, I found with Barnett, I was able to regulate the production of myelin. Myelin being the material that prohibits you or I from, say, regenerating a new hand if we were to have ours cut off.
I don't know, some sort of thought that because babies don't have as much of it, that maybe if you get rid of myelin, that'll make you younger. But like, I'm pretty sure that multiple sclerosis is caused because your immune system attacks myelin sheaths and it's not good. So the science gets a D minus. Lots of cool, interesting points, but none of it is really... I mean, obviously it's sci-fi, it's not accurate anyway, but it's all just a bit haphazard and there's too much of it that, yeah.
Yeah, the salamander arm in particular, it does feel like it's comic book science, quite literally, in that it's exactly the same thing as the character of the lizard in Spider-Man, who also is missing an arm and experiments with lizard DNA and grows it back, but then it goes wrong and he turns into a giant lizard. So... Oh no, he's gone too far. Although I couldn't see if there was in like reading about the production, if that was an intentional homage. It kind of seems too much of a coincidence to not have been intentional, but maybe it is just a case of Chris Carter stumbling across that idea and thinking, oh,
that was my thought, because it seems like either when he was in college or, I don't know, people he's, but he comes across these like these nuggets of ideas and then mutates them, pun intended, into some sort of police procedural, and then you get the X-Files.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very much a show that is a melange of all of the different things he's picked up over the years. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it makes for something a little messy. Another thing I liked about this episode, because we've been a little down on it so far, so I'm going to talk about some of the things I like. Yeah. I like Dick Anthony Williams as Reggie Perdue. He's very good. Like I say, he comes across as a very warm and affectionate mentor, and you get a real sense, even though he's in only half the episode and him and Mulder don't have a huge amount of scenes together, you do get a sense of a pre-existing relationship. And I think he's very good for what little they give him. Also, I thought it was fun looking up that he and Duchovny had worked together before in the movie The Rapture, which had come out a few years before this. Although, from my memory, I'm not sure if they share any scenes in that, because Duchovny is only in the first half of that movie. But he's just like one of those guys. You look at his IMDb, he's been in like 100 things. And yeah, he's always a dependable presence. And I also really like when he and Mulder have their last scene together, where they kind of get into a bit of an argument before Reggie then gets killed, where he's talking about how Mulder is seen as a bit of an embarrassment for the agency, how...
You know, all this talk around here about spooky Mulder, I never used to pay much mind. I figured it was just talk about how paranoid you were and all.
And now?
Remember the day you walked into my office wet from Quantico? You pissed me off just looking at you, but then I saw how your mind worked, how you were always three jumps ahead. It was scary, Mulder. Everybody said so.
I've heard the story.
Yeah, well, maybe you ought to hear it again. You let a lot of people down here in the Bureau. They had big plans for you. A lot of people are saying that spooky Mulder has become an embarrassment, a liability.
What? Are you saying that somebody from the Bureau is behind this?
Maybe, maybe not. It's always best to cover your ass in any event.
I like that they're bringing that element back into there. It kind of fleshes out the general impression of Mulder that has been built up in other episodes as well, where there's this sense that, oh, he was this like brilliant mind and now he's stuck in a basement somewhere not doing anything of any that anyone has any respect for. But it comes with a bit more weight when it's coming from someone who seems to really care about Mulder and wants him to try and do better. And then the other thing I really liked the direction in this episode from Michael Lang, who is a kind of veteran TV director who had been in, who's directed loads of stuff. But he gave a quote where he said that he felt that the show was very good at encouraging people who were coming in as directors to think cinematically and to try and do stuff that you don't usually see on television. And so in this episode, the two things that really leapt out to me is when, I think it's the first time that Barnett calls Mulder, the camera kind of pushes in and tilts up as he stands up. So you go from this fairly normal shot of the phone on the desk to this really intense close-up that's very expressive of Mulder, which I thought was a really nice touch. And then at the end, when Barnett is in the operating theatre, they do this really cool focus pull where it goes from looking through the window on the operating room to focusing on Mulder's reflection in the mirror. So it's like, again, a very, very cool shot, the sort of thing that you see happen in films quite a lot because they have the time to think of these complicated setups, but you don't see a lot in television because television has a much tighter production schedule. So I thought there were a lot of nice touches in this episode in that regard.
Yeah, and speaking of sort of visual things, I did like, it was a bit weird, like, is he in the closet or something talking to Mulder, but when Barnett calls up and it's all black apart from, like, a line of light on his eyes, just so you can sort of just see a sliver of his face, it was, I thought that was really good, because, like, he is talking about how he's everywhere he is.
Fox Mulder.
Barnett?
Trace. You sound surprised.
Well, you know, shouldn't I be?
You know, it's illegal to tape another's phone call
without their express permission. Isn't that what they call it? In some states. What makes you think I'm taping you?
The same thing makes me think you're putting a trace on this call.
What state are you in?
Same state you are. I stood next to you in line for coffee this morning.
I don't think so.
Man, I'm everywhere you are. Everywhere. I own you.
Kind of like he's spying on him, and like that whole setup of being in dark with the line of light, being like he is literally, it felt like he could be really close by, but staring at him through like a space in blinds or through a crack in the door or something like that. So, and the guy who plays both Barnetts does creepy, weird creepy very well. So that was good. And also the salamander hand, for as much as I'm knocking it in principle, the actual prosthetic, when you first kind of get glimpses of it, but then at the end where it's kind of struggling as he's dying on the operating table, I thought that looked super cool. It looked like a giant salamander hand. So yeah. I like that aspect of it. I was on board with it in its reality.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. That was definitely a cool effect that they pulled off well, even if the idea itself is kind of silly and doesn't fit the episode. I think that's the episode in microcosm, is that everyone's working really hard to execute some ideas that are questionable. I think one thing I thought was funny was you mentioned in the synopsis the notes that Mulder keeps receiving from Barnett. I like how they seem to become more of a reach as the episode goes on. Like the first one he gets is Fox can't guard the chicken coop, which is fine. That makes perfect sense. Obviously, Fox Mulder. But then the next one he gets is a hunted fox eventually dies. And that kind of makes me think you probably needed to kill Mulder soon, because it feels like you're running out of ideas to stretch the fox metaphor.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's a fun thing in terms of, particularly the early 90s, you get so many stories about serial killers and people who really like messing with their investigators and things like that. I think the notes are a good way of doing that. And you can tell that Mulder is getting increasingly unnerved by them, and his reaction to them then believably fuels everyone's skepticism about his theories about Barnett in this episode, because obviously the things he's saying are like crazy in the way that the things that Mulder says always are, but then you have this sense of like, oh, he's got a personal involvement in it, he's receiving these notes which are clearly designed to get under his skin, so of course he's being rattled by it. I think the character dynamics in this episode are fairly strong in terms of believably setting up why Scully and Reggie and all the other people would be skeptical of him.
For sure. It seems to me like the supporting kind of forensic-y, science-y people are always good quality. They're always a good time. And I enjoyed Agent Henderson, the writing expert, especially, who gets to deliver a line, basically, I think, the only actually funny line in the whole episode. You know, she's saying, oh...
What do you think?
You just brought this in 10 minutes ago.
You're slipping, Henderson.
10 minutes may be enough time for you, Mulder. Of course, I wouldn't know that from personal experience.
Yeah, seriously, what do you think?
It's all very flirty and bantery, and I really enjoyed that. And her.
Yeah, she's really good. In terms of fun lines, I thought that the one that made me laugh, because it's basically the same joke the Simpsons would do when Mulder and Scully were on the Simpsons, was when they're being called into the jewelry robbery at the start, Scully says...
I still don't get it. What does this have to do with us?
Robbing a jewelry store is a federal crime.
Thank you.
Just kind of like, well, and on The Simpsons, it's the joke where where Scully is looking at, says, well, we got this store of a drug deal coming in tonight. And he says, I'm sure the FBI isn't concerned with things like that. So it's basically the reverse of that joke of being like, why are we being called into this? It's like, well, this is actually the thing the FBI investigates.
That is funny.
So that did make me laugh. It's a kind of like a quick throwaway line, but I enjoyed that.
Another thing that made me laugh but probably shouldn't have done is, and I think especially because last week getting... So I did message Amy, my sister-in-law, about the how long are you allowed to leave someone coding for before you call time of death and stuff like that. And I got a massive long rant about how bad coding is depicted in TV and movies and things like that. So I won't replay everything she said about that episode. But I haven't asked her about this one because I don't need to, because like the doctor, he's not actually... It doesn't even look like he's putting any pressure on Barnett's chest. Instead, the doctor, his body's rocking back and forth, but it's all very slow and like, just like, I was just like, are you not even trying? It just looked so absurd and stupid. And maybe I was more aware of it having received Amy's rant about coding and stuff, but it just looks so bizarre and stupid. So that made me laugh, but obviously it wasn't meant to.
Yeah. I think this is me half remembering something from some first aid training over a decade at this point ago. But I seem to remember being told when we were learning how to do chest compressions as part of a first aid certificate, very told, yeah, you shouldn't do this properly on someone who isn't in need of it because you could cause some real serious harm to their chest. So I could understand maybe if it's just an extra of someone being like, okay, I don't really want to do something that could hurt someone, but really not. Yeah, you're right. They are not putting the effort in.
But they make it look real in just about any other TV, movie, whatever you've seen. Yeah, exactly. Like that, however they do it, they manage to make it look real. But it was just so, and I'm acting it out. Obviously, this is a podcast. You can't see this, but go back and look at it for yourself. Like, it is ridiculous.
He's gently massaging.
Yeah, basically.
To stop a code.
It's like modern dance, interpretive dance of chest compressions as opposed to anything that looks like it's actual chest compressions.
Your heart is a wave. That's kind of what it is. Like, it's just saying, like, you know, like imagine a wave and let your heartbeat follow it. Okay.
You are a Purkinje fiber and we are the embodiment of the. Anyway.
Yeah, maybe it's not mentioned, but they just went to like a holistic hospital or something. Something that's more like alternative medicine was the only place they could get him to after he was shot.
You joke, but in Bristol there is genuinely like a home. I'm probably misrepresenting
homeopathic.
It. Yeah, there's like but I'm like just trying to remember if it's just homeopathy or if it's like complementary medicine or something like that. But there is something, or there was when I lived in Bristol. There was genuinely something like that in Bristol.
Yeah, I'm sure there's places like that everywhere. Just there's always a big market.
This was an NHS one. I think that's what sets it apart from just some whatever place claiming to be a hospital.
Yeah, that definitely is a weird one if it's part of the NHS as opposed to just someone rocking up with herbs and saying like, oh, you know, we'll treat you somehow.
We've got a lovely tea that will make your heart start again.
Mentioned earlier on the aging/de-aging computer thing that they program. I thought that was some nice early 90s tech, some sort of like, I presumably similar to stuff that the actual FBI would be using if someone goes on the lam for years and they need to try and create an impression of what they might look after a certain period of time. The other piece of what feels like a total relic is, as you mentioned in the synopsis, the answering service. The fact that Scully has an answering machine that she can call into with a code, which was just not something that I ever had experience with. Like, we had a answering machine built into into our phone for a few years, but then very quickly it was just, oh yeah, everyone has mobiles, so that's just what you use it for.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's one of those bits of technology that always fascinates me. And you see this a lot in like older films and older sitcoms, like from the 80s and 90s, where people have to phone their answering service to get their messages. It's just like a weird little blip of technological development that I assume seems like totally alien to anyone who was like born in the 2000s.
I know.
At this point.
But it, speaking of this, reminded me of been filling out like, you know, the property information sheet for my house as part of the sale. And in the kind of fixtures and fittings thing, you know, it was asking whether a thing was there and whether it's included. And I got to the thing where it said telephone receiver. And for the life of me, I was like, wait, is that like a telephone or is that the wire of the telephone or some other thing that comes into the house? And I genuinely had to Google this just to double check, like, wait, what do you actually mean here? So, yeah, telephone technology and everything, the peripherals associated with it, just increasingly seem completely irrelevant.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to think that that has really all happened in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Because obviously when we were children, no one had a mobile phone. Mm-hmm. Everyone had landlines. That was the only way you could communicate to someone, or you, I guess, pagers. Like, I never knew anyone who had a pager, but, you know, that was obviously something that people who were adults with jobs would have pagers. And just now, everyone has a phone that, you know, you can get infinite number of calls on, check emails and everything. Like, that development was so rapid in our, I guess, adolescence and teen years, really.
Yeah, and I often find it mad to think about, you know, sort of people who, I guess, are sort of grandparents' ages where... Or like my you know, my daddy's in his 70s. Like, back when he was a kid, not everyone, maybe only one person had a TV on his street or something. And, you know, not many people had cars in their families, if anyone, especially because he was growing up in the arse end of nowhere in Scotland. To, like, that whole transition is mad. Like, I've always felt like the technological transitions for us have been far less kind of groundbreaking or earth-shattering, because it's felt like incremental developments of stuff we already had, but it is still a lot of development. And that sort of takes me to that back and forth that Mulder and Scully have, you know, when Mulder's talking about, oh, maybe we're actually looking for someone, Barnett, but like a lot younger. You know, he's caught on to this idea of de-aging, and Scully says that's science fiction.
You don't just reverse aging.
Ridley's found a way.
Listen to what you're saying.
He wanted human research subjects, right? Prisoners. Prisoners like John Barnett.
Mulder, it's science fiction.
Well, what would you have said 20 years ago about gene splicing, DNA fingerprinting, cloning, artificial intelligence? Maybe we're not looking for a man in his late 40s after all. Maybe John Barnett has found the perfect disguise. Youth.
It's funny to think that they're talking in 1993, you know, more than 30 years ago, and you'd think, oh, artificial intelligence has gone mad over the last, like, 12 to 18 months or something. Back in the 90s, AI was still science fiction. And in fact, people talk about AI and, you know, gene editing in humans, at least, as science fiction. But it did get me thinking quite a lot about When exactly does science fiction stop being sci-fi and start being just science fact? And in fact, I mean, all science fiction movie stories are really about humanity and the human condition. They're very rarely really focused on the science and the technology, but more its impact on people and individuals and society. But yeah, you talking about telephones and answering machines, and, you know, now we have smartphones, and I'm talking to you in Florida, I'm here in Oxford, I've got my laptop here, my foldable smartphone there, that you're like, it's just like, whoa, the future's here, man. It's great. So yeah, I obviously, in my week alone, I fell down some deep rabbit holes of thought about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I liked that little speech that Mulder has, because again, it's but even though it underlines the problems this episode have, where it feels like there's a lot of stuff going on underneath the surface of this episode, there's a lot of things it's trying to address and things that it's interested in, but like, none of them really kind of sink their teeth into you, really. Then none of them really take hold. And that's one of the ones where you think, oh yeah, that's, you know, I guess that is quite an interesting thing to think about, all these things that in the early 90s are kind of like taking off and it's kind of a nice rejoinder to Scully's skepticism. It's like, oh, you know, that's such a ridiculous thing that you're suggesting. It's like, well, you know, all these things that we now have and know can exist, these, you know, were all considered ridiculous not too long ago. So, like, that's kind of like a fun rejoinder, but then the episode doesn't really do anything with it. I also think this episode, in terms of looking at other episodes where maybe things are a little too biased towards Mulder and Scully's counter-arguments feel a little weak, I feel this episode does at least have a pretty good balance between the two of them. You know, when they first hear about Dr. Ridley and, you know, the idea is like, oh, it's a discredited doctor, said that he's dead. So there's a reasonable argument for the idea that, oh, Barnett, you know, just faked his death and is out there doing something, which is the more logical explanation for than he actually did die, but then he came back to life because of the anti-aging thing or whatever, you know, is actually happening. I think that is nicely done, that it does feel, like you said, it does feel like there is at least a decent amount of ambiguity in the episode as to what actually is going on, but then the actual revelation for what's going on isn't that impressive or that exciting, really.
Yeah, I think where you've got mystery and you don't really know and you're waiting to find out whilst this plot kind of unravels or reveals itself, that's all great. Once you do know, I don't know. But also that thing that has been happening a lot in these first episodes of The X-Files, where it's playing in the, is it paranormal or weird science, or are there more logical, earthly explanations for these things? This episode, you've got the mystery of what's happening, but it, you know, once it does start revealing what's going on and you see the salamander hand, and then Scully finds that Barnett's fingerprint is on her answering machine and things like that, like, it doesn't leave any space for you to really think it could be either or. It really is. Barnett is there. He looks younger. He's got a salamander hand, and we know it's Barnett because of the fingerprint at the very least. And so it doesn't leave any space for you to argue back and forth about whether or not it's as the weirdness suggests it is, or if it's more logical. It's just like, no, this is all weird shit.
Yeah, this doctor did discover something that allows you to de-age, and it killed most of the people that he worked on, but this one guy it worked with. And as the final shot of the locker at the train station indicates, the research is still out there waiting for someone to find it and de-age themselves with, I guess. It's another case where, like with Deep Throat being brought in and talking about how the government's interested in this stuff, like the idea that the research is still out there and someone could stumble on it.
Where do you think it is?
Who knows? If Barnett didn't destroy it, he could have stashed it anywhere. Which would have a certain cruel irony, wouldn't it? Scientific knowledge that could change the course of mankind, buried out in a field somewhere, or sitting in some safe deposit box, getting old just like the rest of us.
If he didn't destroy it, chances are that somehow, someday, somebody will find it.
And when they do, maybe he didn't get his revenge from beyond the grave, but somehow I feel like we haven't heard the last from John Barnett.
It's not as sinister a ending as I think the episode is going for. It kind of reminded me of, there's an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer where it turns out that one of the teachers at the school is a giant praying mantis who kills the young men in order to feed on them,
as you do,
and then at the end of the episode they show that there's like a bunch of sacks of eggs behind like one of the lockers or something, and it's meant to be like, oh, they're going to hatch and there's going to be more of it, and then the show never did anything with that again. It's never mentioned. It's just there as like kind of like an X-Files style stinger, but it kind of reminded me of that, but if instead of showing eggs, it just showed like, I don't know, someone's homework or something. It's just like, it's not as is not as exciting to say that this person's research is sitting in a locker somewhere and something might happen with it. Who knows?
And, you know, finishing off by Mulder saying, I don't think this is the last we've heard of from Michael Burnett or whatever it is. And I was,
John Burnett.
Yeah, this isn't the last we've heard from John Burnett. I was just like, dear God, no, I hope it is. He's dead now, it's fine. We don't need to hear more about this. But yeah, I guess the other thing is, and I don't know if I've been swayed because, you know, we do have these billionaires. I think probably Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, and I'm sure I've heard stories of them putting money into companies that are supposedly trying to research eternal youth and all this kind of thing. I'm sure I've come across these stories.
And there's the really famous one, Peter Thiel, the guy behind PayPal, who used to get blood transfusions from younger men.
Yeah, exactly.
As a way of fighting off aging. Yeah, that's kind of like the really famous
one. So I feel like maybe it would have been more realistic not for it to not be a government conspiracy, but I don't know if that makes it not feel X-file-y enough, because obviously the X-Files really hinges on government conspiracies and things like that.
The last note I have on this one, I think the music in this episode is pretty good. Obviously the music in the show is usually pretty good. Mark Snow was a very good composer. He had a good sense of mood, but I thought that, you know, there's a lot of really sparse piano in this episode that feels really disorientating, particularly I think during the scene when Mulder is going to that kids football game. I noticed the music there was kind of like, was really, really effective. Oh yeah, and the other thing is, it looks like absolute misery playing football on that muddy field, because it just looked horrible. It looked like they were filming on the worst day of the year for a bunch of kids to... It actually looks more like practice, because there's not enough kids on the field. And also, there's like actual soccer nets on the field, so I presume he's just going to the practice for the kids, which is a weird thing for a guy.
Mulder does weird things around kids. I think it's weird.
Yeah,
like playing football in Scotland, really, that with the pitches like that. Just to kind of go back to the music, like, generally speaking, it's kind of good and it works, but I don't know if tonally the kind of demonic, suggestive, the choir singing that sort of suggestive of something more satanic and demonic, I don't know if it fits.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's good, and we'll see when he applies that to genuinely demonic stuff. It works super effectively, you know, as kind of a musical trope. It obviously works super well, but just for this for the content of this particular episode, it jarred a little, for me.
Yeah, it's like when we were talking about Lazarus, where they start using the creepy pizzicato strings for seemingly no good reason over like a normal scene. It's a misapplication of a really good piece of music that would make more sense elsewhere. Yeah, and that mud also just reminded me about when I would have to play like rugby in PE, and like in, you know, rural Leicestershire, sometimes the mud was just so terrible and you just get so filthy over the course of an hour of playing rugby incredibly badly, as was often the case with me.
It's character building.
Where?
So they say.
So what would you rate this episode of The X-Files, Michaela?
I'm going to give it a 5. It's fine, I guess. I just, I didn't find it super enjoyable. And I guess for me, of the episodes that feature cat and mouse killer, weirdness, science experimentation, government conspiracy gone wrong, like, we've seen all of that in other episodes really good. And so I think part of probably why I feel a bit down on it is because we've seen it in other episodes pretty good. And it's, as we've discussed, it's just together, it's not done very well in this episode. So I guess I was a bit bored by it. And there's just quite a bit of misfiring, despite there being some fun, good and interesting elements to it. So it's probably out maybe slightly below average, But I guess that's a 5 for me. How about you?
I think I'm going to give it a 4 because I think in talking about it, it became more apparent to me just how much of the stuff in this episode feels like warmed over, like stuff that has been done better in other episodes. And whilst there are like individual episodes, like I think the directing is strong, you know, some of the supporting performances are really good. Ultimately, it doesn't really hang together in a way that even something like Lazarus, which is another kind of middling episode, you know, has functions a little more better and moves like more swiftly. Mm-hmm. I feel like this one, it just kind of sputters about quite a bit. So yeah, and the things I like about it aren't really quite enough to bump it into like the above average range. So yeah, I would probably give it a 4. Thanks everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast, then please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, and recommend us to your friends. It's the best way to help us grow our audience. You can also find us on Twitter, where we're at The Far Room Pod. And you can also email us at thefarroompod@gmail.com. If you have a salamander arm, sure, let us know. Yeah. That'd be interesting.
Or if you've done crazy science experiments, love to hear about them.
Yeah, always fun to hear about those. Our music is by Leonel Cassio. We'll be back next time with the episode EBE, which I'm very excited
to. Yes, me too.
Some big things coming in EBE for the overall arc of the X-Files, so that'll be fun to talk about. But until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
The paranormal is real. It is real.